Welcome to Between the Lines, an Oaks Church Brooklyn podcast where we go behind the scenes of our current series, The Story of God, alongside our pastors and a few friends. We hope you enjoy. Well, welcome back, everyone, to Between the Lines. I'm here with Patrick.
And I'm here with Ryan.
And we're back to talk about Moses. We're starting. We're in it. We're in Exodus. We're in the story, a new chapter, a new beginning.
Yeah, but the same old story.
Same old story. Honestly, it's what it feels like.
Spinning the hits.
But yeah. So man, so much was in the teaching on Sunday, and one lingering question that people had as you kind of enter the story of the Exodus with water, right? There's like the Nile River, which is the source of life for the Egyptians, mm-hmm. but it becomes this bastion of death for the Hebrew children, Hebrew boys specifically. And so, yeah, I think someone kind of was lingering with, what are your thoughts on this kind of repeated theme of water we see throughout scriptures, the flood, creation, and then going into the crossing of the Jordan for the people of Israel? So this water seems to matter a lot.
Yeah. I got to say, Sunday was so fun. I have personally just been blessed and love being in this series. It's been really cool to see essentially questions even like these, where I think what I've been given witness to is the way in which the scriptures have come alive in a whole new way, the way we're interacting with the scriptures, the way we're thinking about the scriptures, to think holistically about a question like that. Like, what is the role of water throughout the narrative, right? Yeah. Throughout the story of God, is fascinating when you think about, honestly, the first instance of water, which is like Genesis 1 and 2, that there's the waters, the Spirit of God is hovering over the waters of the earth that are, you know, that have rendered the world unordered and uninhabited. And so right off the bat, you have like water as almost like a symbol of chaos, like, yeah. Neutral chaos. We've talked about this, but chaos nonetheless. Like you know, you can live in it, you can operate in it, but it will eventually master you if you allow it, and it makes it impossible for life to thrive. And so it has to stay within its bounds. And isn't that like this kind of? Yeah, I just find that so fascinating. How, you know, even as a person who cannot swim. Can you swim?
Yeah, I can swim.
Okay, all right. I guess it's a New York thing. And
well, we had a really awesome public pool. Shout out to Astoria Pool.
Yeah, that's cool. I don't, you know, we could go, you know, black and brown people in water, but talk about that later. I don't swim. Sure. And frankly, it's been too long. My son is learning how to swim, and I'm happy for him. But for me, I don't really mess around with water in like large formats. So, you know, pools, oceans, blizzards, like I'm kind of out.
Blizzards?
I don't like snow.
It's a solid at that point.
It doesn't matter. It's still water. Do you want to be trapped in a blizzard?
All I'm saying
is me and large things of water, I'm cool with, and yet I need water to live.
Sure.
I got to drink water. Water and I have a contentious relationship.
Sure.
Anyway, the Bible and water has a contentious relationship.
Yeah.
Where I'm trying to go with this. So you see it. You start there. It's chaos. And then it has to be ordered. And then you have the flood where it becomes disordered again and tries to just, it wipes everything out. And then it gets ordered again. And then you have this, here we have the, again, this Nile and this like prototypical Jesus and Moses that comes through. On the waters, we'll get to the Red Sea, what it means to pass through chaos, right? What does it mean later when baptism comes to be buried in water but overcome it? What does it mean to be buried in chaos and to be overcome the chaos of the world? So that's so interesting to me. And then you end with essentially the city of God with rivers running through it. And they're yeah. kind of like ordered. I don't know. What do you make of yeah. the motif of water?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's obviously a motif, and specifically this idea of rivers and kind of you have the rivers running out of Eden and all these kinds of examples of people crossing rivers and crossing seas. But I think what's interesting, I think there's so much to talk about, but I think what I land particularly that's interesting for us in this narrative of Exodus is what the Nile represents. So the Nile obviously exists on a floodplain. And so the agriculture of the Egyptian people is entirely dependent on the cycle of flooding that happens to the Nile. And there's actually this kind of predictable nature in which you always know when the Nile is going to flood. So you never have to even worry about rain. And so the Nile becomes central to Egyptian agriculture and religion. And so it makes sense then when you understand that, number one, that like the first plague, which, you know, spoiler alert, the plagues come. Mm-hmm. The first plague strikes at the very heart of Egyptian life, which is the Nile.
Blood in the water.
There's blood in the water. And it's also symbolic, too, because there has been blood in the water, the blood of the Hebrew children. And that's even interesting, too, as we watch Israel leave Egypt and head towards Canaan. They are leaving a place that has this kind of predictable rhythms of flooding, which makes agriculture predictable. And they're moving into a place where you have to be dependent on rain. And so we hear the Israelites, part of their qualms about this desire to go back to Egypt is also part and parcel with this idea that that is a land in which things are predictable.
The devil you know.
Yeah. And actually to go into a land like Canaan is actually to be utterly dependent on God, because in the Hebrew imagination, the only person who makes it rain is Yahweh.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's so much happens around this relation to the predictability of rivers and the unpredictability of rain in the two different lands that makes it understandable why later on Israel gets so enamored with the gods of the Canaanites who can seemingly predict and you can barter with them for rain. It's so interesting.
You know, you just sparked a thought in my head that I'd not had before, a connection you just made, thinking about the Nile and the first plague and it turning into blood. And what immediately popped into my mind, which is what happens, this is why we're doing the story. I love yeah. when you get a call back, is Cain's blood calling out to Yahweh.
Yeah.
And Yahweh coming to Abel and saying, like, your blood, your brother's blood is calling out from the ground, and it's provoked me to have to come moved and create justice, right? Yeah. And for the water, where, to your point, all Pharaoh had condemned all Yahweh's people. And to turn it into blood, like, it's almost like this chorus
yeah.
that's just condemning this empire
yeah.
in Egypt. Like, and it's him signaling, like, I've had to come answer to this blood.
Yeah.
This blood is calling out, and I have to come answer to it. I have to come free my people. I don't know. I just thought about that. That was...
Yeah. There's so much there. I mean, even like we get to the Gospels and Jesus walking on water and calming the storms. Mm. Well, in like the Old Testament imagination, who's the only person who can do that but Yahweh?
Yeah.
It's just so much is there. It's a lot.
I love it.
But so, I mean, honestly, I mean, just like we could talk about this ad nauseum, I think we can also recognize that every kind of teaching stuff gets left on the cutting room floor.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I mean, as you were preparing for this, what was something of interest or note? They're like, man, I wish I could go there, but we also have to get out of church on time.
Yeah. Actually, we got out, you know, a little early this week.
Yeah,
so,
it felt good.
You know. As a person who's once dropped a 50-piece on this teaching, your boy's come a long way. We'll give you a smooth 27 and get it on out of there. yeah, it was not so much for time's sake, but for just what it opens up. But I opened with the story that has long fascinated me, which is Ayuba Suleiman Diallo, who is this African prince from like modern day Senegal, who gets sold into slavery and then essentially writes his way out, which I say is only the like second most confounding escape, second only to Henry Box Brown, true story if you don't know it, who literally got a friend, got a shopkeeper to put him in a box, and homeboy mailed himself to freedom. That is a real story. What will Brown do for you? Like if he doesn't get a UPS like memorial, I don't know what they're doing. But anyway, Diallo, the story is basically, yeah, it's kind of this like riches to rags to riches. He gets back home. But what is fascinating, what I couldn't get into, is Diallo was caught. Diallo was a prince whose kingdom practiced selling other tribes into slavery. This was common throughout kind of West Africa during the especially the rise and start of the transatlantic slave trade. And so Bundu was his empire. The Mandingos were their one of their rival tribes. And so he sells two Mandingo men into slavery in exchange for paper and other goods from Portugal. And then he, on his way back, he gets stopped by other Mandingo tribesmen who capture him and sell him into slavery. And there's kind of this weird thing like, oh, well, that's kind of weird. I don't know how much, because like, you know, in the moment, it's kind of like, man, there's such a beautiful story of survival. And then you're like, oh, wait, this dude like also sold slaves. And then you realize his experience as even a slave. So he, when he essentially got to Maryland and was a slave, his enslaver kind of quickly realized that he wasn't like the other slaves in the way he operated and moved. And so he moved him out of the field, and Diallo was actually tasked with shepherding cattle. And so essentially his experience of American slavery wasn't kind of like what we would think when we think of like Kunta Kinte or when we think of some of these other really tragic slave stories. Now, he's still in forced servitude. Obviously, he runs away. Like, he doesn't want to be there. But that's such an interesting thing that I think is also concretized in the fact that, like, he gives his enslaver the letter, that his enslaver doesn't immediately just, like, tear up and, like, punish him for riding in the first place, but, like, actually sends it to people and it gets where, it, you know. And then all that to say, Diallo then, after, you know, these British aristocrats secure his freedom, he comes and joins, like, London high society, dines with the king and queen, and then eventually makes his way back to his home. But he does so as an employee of the Africa Company, still in the slave trade.
That's crazy.
And, like, the turns and the complexities of people. I could have talked a long time just about that. And I told that story for a couple of different reasons. One, because that poem, I think, just has some language that really kind of speaks to the Moses motif and the Moses kind of like story. But in the same way, I think Moses is just such a complex figure.
Yeah, some would say tragic.
Yeah, like his story doesn't end where you think it would, just like Diallo's doesn't. And he's also, you know, he is a murderer. He gets really angry with people sometimes. I don't know. It's just interesting. So we couldn't explore that. I guess what was on the cutting room floor was the complexity of humans. And even when we think about this, think about Pharaoh's daughter. And maybe this is just like daughter stuff and like kids. They just like, I'm not going to do what you tell me. But she's like, oh, here's this Hebrew boy that did my dad just like condemn them all to death. But like, oh, I like this one. I'll keep it. Such an interesting, I don't know, was it, did she keep Moses out of, you know, exoticism, fetishism, like, oh, this is just this cute little pet I'll have? Was she moved by, like, love? I was like, oh, look at this, you know, this nice boy. I don't know. People are so complex, so.
Yeah, I think even as you say that, I think that's part of the reason. And I think over the weeks, questions have repeated around these kind of complex characters we see in the Bible. And for some people, that is a point of, can be a point of pain or confusion, as like, why all these jacked up people in the Bible that God works with?
Yeah.
And I don't know, but for me, that has always been a source of great encouragement and grace. Mm-hmm. That the Bible does not shy away. Even its heroes are not heroes.
No.
And at worst, they're redeemed villains. Yes. You know, and so I think that's what always made the Bible compelling to me. It's just like, man, if you're going to tell a story about a special people and a God who's redeeming them, you might have painted their picture a little brighter, but no, it's like, here's the fullness of humanity.
Yes. Which, I just want to get a little soapbox.
No, no, go for it.
Because I feel like you're a poet.
Yeah.
I used to be a photographer in a different life and fancy myself a dabbler in creativity.
Yeah.
I feel like this is the problem with Christian art.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
That we take out the complexity of people.
Yeah.
And it's so flat and we can't really deal with the not just the darkness of the Christians in the story, but like just the darkness of the world at large. Yeah. And it ends up, like, as a photographer, if you don't have enough contrast, everything's just washed out. And I feel like so much of art that's made in the name of God isn't really informed by the complexity of the scriptures they're inspired by.
It's funny. I think, this is a soapbox, but for me as well. But, like, I think part of it's too, I think it's like, you know, like the meat industry in America is like you go to the store to get this kind of clean, nicely packaged cut of meat. You don't have to sit through the slaughter.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that is part and parcel of why some maybe American evangelical Christian produce some bad art, a lot of bad art, is that it's like we want the little morsel at the end you can kind of throw on your grill, and you don't have to go out to a field and pick a cow to slaughter.
Listen, that is the truth. As a son, a grandson of a farmer who at a young age saw a chicken get its head chopped off, real South Carolina stuff. It's very traumatizing.
Yeah.
It still sticks with me. You know, they still can move after their heads are chopped off. We should probably keep
moving. Yeah, let's keep it moving. Keep moving. So I think a lot of questions that also came forward was like, again, there's so much going on in our world, especially in the region of Israel-Palestine. And so there is this question of how do these ancient stories relate to this modern situation? And I'd wonder, how would you lead someone into answering that question?
Yeah, you know, we got a couple of questions about that, some flavor of, you know, what does this mean? And I think that's a very good and great question, you know, that, you know, we talked about last week in the waypoint about, hey, the Bible's not written to make us good Israelites, and it's definitely not written to make Israelites in the shape of good Americans.
Sure.
But it is about a particular people and then their relationship to a God that is now our God still 2,000 years. And what can we learn about who this God is and who we are? And I just say, I start there to say, like, it's almost a word of caution that I would first give because there are motifs. Like someone asked on Sunday about, I forget the thing they were pointing to. Man, slipping my mind now, but it was something to the extent of, I think maybe it was like sons, or you can listen to the recording and hear the question that was asked. But essentially they were talking about, hey, there's this motif that still happens today. It was about population control.
Mm.
and population control that, again, happens throughout the Bible, and we talked a little bit about moving today. But the thing I want to say is that, like, yes, there's nothing new under the sun, but we have to be cautious about looking at the Bible as, like, an allegory.
Yeah.
Meaning that we should read a story and go, like, oh, clearly we're the Israelites, and they're... this person is Moses, and, you know, and this kind of, like, we're doing, like, this kind of deduction thing to try to see who's who and kind of read the future. I think we have to be very careful about that. That is not actually how we're called to read or understand even narratively the story of God. And so I don't want to do is to say, like, oh, well, clearly, like, America would be Egypt, and you can get in a lot of trouble that way. I think the better questions to ask, the ones I would invite us into as we listen to these stories, is what does this tell us about the immutable nature and character of God, right? Mm-hmm. So in him, there is no turning or shadow, right? He is the same today, yesterday, and forever. Now, God has immense complexity that's like constantly evolving and constantly growing, but not constantly changing. His love is kind of like this thing that keeps moving in complexity.
Eternally generative.
There we go. This is why we pay you the medium bucks. So that said, I think, like, for this, when I look into this story, bringing it forward, what do I see of God? I see something about this God that is long-suffering, in the sense of, my wife, when I got home, she was like, oh, I was going to blow that Q&A up. And I was like, what? What do you mean? She's like, I was going to ask, how does God allow genocide? And I was like, oh, I got you. Well, I feel like we've asked this question, like, every week. But I hear you. I hear you, love. So for my wife, shout out Catherine, why does God allow genocide? I don't really know.
Sure.
It's above my pay grade, but I do know that he is really patient with suffering and with man's inhumanity to man. And I also know that he has a different view of death than we do. And I think of what it makes me think of is, like, my son, who has a different view of going to sleep than I do. Like, for him, going to sleep is a form of death. Like, he has no real concept for tomorrow, you know? So at 4 years old, he's like, I cannot go to bed. Like, what do you mean? I'm having so much fun in this day. I don't want this to end. And I'm like, buddy, we can't get to tomorrow if we don't have today. Like, it'll be okay. You have to go to sleep. Mm. And I think about that with us as death. Like, we're just like, these 80, if we're lucky, 100 years, this is what we have. And like, I can't go to sleep. Sleeping would be the worst thing in the world. Mm. And the Lord's like, you're an eternal being. It'll be okay. Mm. It'll be okay. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord.
Mm.
1,000 years in the company of the Lord is like a second here on earth. So he just has a different view of death is something. And then I want to hear your take. This last thing I offer is, I think the second thing we can do is ask, like, what do stories like this speak of to us, of our character and the character of humanity? And for me, one thing that arises is Moses and what happens at the end where we left off, where Moses has this view of injustice, right? So he witnesses one of his fellow men being roughed up. He witnesses a slave, this person is slave being roughed up by this Egyptian. And his response to it is to take justice into his own hands. And so he murders the Egyptian, buries his body. And, you know, there's a way of looking at it going, like, well, good on you, Moses. Like, you weren't complicit You know, you stood up to injustice in the world. And we know that we have a call of Christ, right? What has he shown us what is good? To do justice, okay? But who's justice?
Yeah.
He kills the Egyptian, but it doesn't free that man. And the next day, it all just gets thrown back in his face.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't actually produce life. It only produces more death when he pursues good justice on his terms. God's justice on man's terms produces death. And it's like, and that to me in this age where there's just so much, we're so hyper aware of everything that's wrong in the world. It's inundating our phones and it can lead to a sense of just like hopelessness, but also like I've got to do something or I'm complicit in it. And I think it can rile us up to be like, I will make my justice in the world. And it just, for me, it's like, man, the history of the world tells us that man's justice only just produces more death, but God's justice is eternally generative.
So, yeah.
I don't know. What about you?
Yeah, no, I think as I sit with that, I think there's two things that come up for me. I think one is that you mentioned that Micah passage, right? Do justice. And the second part of it is love mercy. And so I think that's something interesting in our culture that we have this great desire for justice, but we have no idea what to do with mercy.
Yeah.
And so I think that's something I just sit with, that
unless I need it.
Right, unless I need it, unless I'm a beneficiary of mercy, yes. Then it makes sense.
Yes.
But we don't know quite what to do with the intersection of justice and mercy, which is why you need the cross, and it's why you need Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah.
Because there, God's mercy and his justice meet perfectly. And so, yeah, I just sit with that and say, I think as I listen to some of these questions that come in, it's like, in our great cries for justice, which are necessary and good, God also tells us to love mercy. And I wonder what would our justice look like if we held to that tenet. And then thirdly, what would then happen in holding those things we walked humbly with God? That would maybe change the tenor of what our pursuit of justice looked like, because now I'm humbling myself under God, and now whatever his vision of justice and mercy looked like, I accept as my own. But that's one thing I sit with. Yeah.
Because you're so right. I want to say like amen and ugh at the same time.
I think that's kind of the point.
Because yeah. Even as I hear that, I immediately go like, man, that sounds like a cop out. You know what I'm saying? Like, it sounds like,
yeah,
it sounds like, oh, to love mercy. It's like, bro, there's a boot on my neck. Don't tell me about mercy.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be free. Like, people are dying. And like, how do you make sense of that tension for everyone who's going like,
yeah,
bro, don't tell me about mercy when people are dying, when children are dying.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, again, I think this is why I find the Bible so fascinating. This is Jonah's dilemma. This is his issue. The Babylonians are a violent, oppressive empire that has oppressed his people. And what God goes to tell him is to go preach that my judgment is coming. But Jonah knows that if he goes and preaches that judgment is coming, the people might turn and change. There might be, and God might relent on his judgment.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, what we all feel. We all feel the tension of Jonah, that if I go and proclaim the need for justice, if someone turns and relents, God in his mercy will meet that person or those people. And so it's why Jonah stubbornly goes to Nineveh, preaches this kind of half message on what God asked him to preach. And then the people relent and God shows them mercy and Jonah is rightfully ticked off. And the story doesn't resolve itself. All we get is a picture of Jonah sitting under a tree he didn't plant and enjoying its shade, only to be angry when it's taken away from him. And that's it. That's what we're left with. We're left with the tension.
Oh.
That God will show mercy to whom he shows mercy. And it is invigorating and gets under my skin personally when that happens until I'm the recipient. And then I have to say, why am I okay with God's mercy for me and not for others? And I have to sit in that tension. So I don't think that's an answer.
Because I want them to be punished.
Yeah.
It is funny. I think of like when you get an argument with like your wife or, you know, your partner, and there's this disagreement, and then they like, instead of like ratcheting up the disagreement, they're like, "You're right. I'm sorry." Yeah. You're like, "Wait, what?"
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say this. One final thought is that the great Christian claim is that someone does get punished.
Okay. There you go.
We'll leave it there.
That's a shout out for Robbie Brown. Just taking it back to Jesus. This all comes back to Jesus.
Amen.
All right. Let's
resources.
Resources. Let's do some resources.
What do you got?
And get out of here. Well, you know, speaking of Christian art, I don't know if this is actually qualifies as a Christian art, but I've just found it really fascinating and perfectly well-timed. I love a good assist. Netflix just recently released this kind of docudrama on Moses, called Testament, the Story of Moses. I'm like halfway through the first episode, and it's fascinating. They kind of do this narrative, I don't know what you call that word, like reenactment almost, of Moses's life, really high production value. And then they also intersperse all different types of theologians and ancient scholars who are kind of talking about Moses and his life and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a really fascinating to get a fuller kind of just picture on how other people see this story. And yeah, I would recommend it.
Yeah, my resource for today is it's an ancient resource. It's from St. Gregory of Nyssa, who is a 4th century saint. And he wrote this work called The Life of Moses. And it's his kind of take of a mystical, contemplative reading of the Moses story. And I think as we've been mired in sort of the, not mired is a strong word, but as we've been in some of these modern questions of, and these kind of modern applications of the story of Exodus and Moses, it's interesting to just get some perspective on how someone in the 4th century was reading the story really as a treatise on contemplation and entering the mystery of God.
I think there is something so telling. We both bring stories of Moses, and yours is rooted in 4th century manuscripts, and mine is rooted in Netflix.
You know, that's why we work great together.
Just go leave it at that. Until next time.
Peace.